Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. I'm delighted to be joined by two New York Times bestselling novelists who happen to live right here in Arizona, and both of whom I met through Barbara Peters' wonderful, world-famous, independent Poison Pen bookshop in Scottsdale. Jen McKinley is the award-winning best-selling author of several mystery and romance series, and her work has been translated into multiple languages and in countries all over the world. Hard at work on her next books, Jen's latest releases include Love at First Book, Fondant Fumble, and her upcoming holiday-themed mystery, A Merry Little Murder Plot, is available on October 8th. I love that name. Paige Shelton had a nomadic childhood as her father's job as a football coach took the family to seven different towns before she was even 12 years old. After college at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, Paige moved to Salt Lake City, where she thought she'd only stay a few years, but she fell in love with the mountains and a great guy who became her husband. In 2015, her family moved to Arizona. In addition to the Scottish bookshop mysteries, she also writes the Alaska Wild series, which began with Thin Ice. Her other series include The Farmer's Market, Cooking School, and Dangerous Type Mystery Series. Perfect Storm, the sixth Alaska Wild series title, will be out on December 3rd, 2024. And Written in Stone, the 10th Scottish bookshop mystery, is coming to stores on April 1st of 2025. Ladies, I want to thank you so much for being here. I've loved your events at Poison Pen, and it's so exciting to talk to people who love books and movies right in my own area. So how are you doing?
Great. Yeah. Thanks for having us. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. This is great.
Yeah, my pleasure. No, it's always a joy seeing you. Also seeing just how much you support the store and you go to other events. It's been very cool. See you and kind of start recognizing people who love books as much as you do. I mean, who are also writers, of course. And when we were coming up with a theme, I realized that you both not only enjoy indie bookstores like Poison Pen and libraries as much as I do, but you also write mysteries set in bookshops. So bookshop movies seemed like the perfect fit. Before we dive in, I'd love to talk more about your own backgrounds with books and writing and what got you started. Jen, I know you were a librarian. Did you always love books and want to be a writer from a young age?
I did. My mom was a librarian. So, you know, Saturday mornings were spent going to get the weekly haul.
Oh, and, wow.
You know, every reader is like, oh, yeah, Saturday morning at the library.
Yeah.
And, you know, she read to us every night. So I did the same with mine. You know, we're one of those people, family type of families. So books just were kind of always the, like, you could get out of chores in my house if you were reading.
Oh, like, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It was like, you need to do the dishes. One more chapter, you know, because my mom is book nerd too. So it would be like, all right, but then you have to do the reading. So my brother and I figured out how to weaponize reading.
Okay.
But also I just loved it. I mean, you know, life is hard. Like, the teen years are tough. So books just like were really, you know, a nice escape, an area of temporary refuge. I like to think of them.
Oh, I love that. That's really brilliant. Yeah. And writing was another thing. Did you love it from as a kid on? Did you want to be an author?
It didn't even occur to me that it was a job until I was like a teenager. When I was really little, I would write like the family newspaper to make money, to buy candy because, my siblings gave me a lot to work with. So when I think I was a teenager before it occurred to me that writing is an actual like profession, but then I didn't do anything with it, for like 10 years. You see a lot of young authors come up and I'm always just like, I wasn't ready. Like, God bless.
Need some life.
I needed to screw up. I needed to craft a lot of my own bad behavior stories. So, yeah. So I didn't even start writing for real until I was like 25. And then I think it took me till I was 31 to sell a book. So it was like 6 years of really committed. Like the idea came as a teenager. I went to college. I was an English major for a little while. And then I was like, oh, I don't want to teach English. Yuck. So I pivoted into library science. So I had English and library science. And I was like, oh, I could be a librarian. I could work with books. That'll be great. And then, and it was. And I loved being a librarian. But yeah, the writing was just kind of a side hustle. And it didn't really come to anything until I was in like 30, 31.
That's cool. How about you, Paige? Did you enjoy writing in books early on?
I think my love of writing started when I was about 7. I think
Oh.
I remember writing a poem, and I mean, this will date me, but when I was 7, it was like the early 70s, and so I had this notebook that had the psychedelic art on the outside of it, and I put stickers on it, like stickers of candy
Yeah.
sticks and stuff like that, the stuff that we all did back when we were kids in those days. But in that notebook, on a pink piece of paper, I wrote a poem about a kite. It's very short. I'll go through it quickly. Fly, fly through the air. That kite will never give me a care. One day I went to fly my kite, and my kite flew out of sight. Well, that poem hooked
I
me
love
forever.
it.
The imagery. Yeah.
It hooked me immediately, and I'm like, I need to write words. This needs to be my life. I never really thought of it as a profession either, like Jen was talking. And then in 1999, I decided to take it seriously, this dream I had. And I'm like, well, surely I'll be published by year 2000. Of course, if I start now, I'm going to be good. And if the world doesn't fall apart at Y2K, it's going to be terrific. And I did not get published until 2010. So it took a little longer than what I thought, and a lot longer span than what Jen's was. But it took quite some time to find my groove and find somebody who wanted to publish the books.
Yeah, but that's cool. You also lived and you had more experience and stuff to bring to these books that you were writing, which is really important. But I do love that at least words and books were kind of important to you both as at a young age. I'm similar. My mom worked in a library when I was a kid, and so I have like great memories of going and helping her. I mean, it was just the children's department, but put away books and be able to bring home things. My parents were a little open-minded. I think my dad showed us things we really shouldn't have watched, like Platoon at like age 8 or 9, like stay in the other room. We're not staying in the other room. And, stuff that we would get from the library, the movies, and of course, books. I remember those. I'm going to age myself, but in the 80s, Pizza Hut had that thing, Book It, where you could earn pizza. Libraries had stickers if you read 30 books, all of that stuff. And then when I was older, I worked in a middle school library to kind of do the same thing. And it was just really exciting. But I also love that you guys, you, Paige, kind of started out early wanting to write so many notebooks, right? That we had over the years. And I was one of those nerdy kids who at 11, one of my teachers said, you're good with dialogue. You should write a script. And for me, that was okay tomorrow. So I taught myself to write a script, like again, books at the library. And I called the affiliate of NBC, pretended I wanted to send Jerry Seinfeld a fan letter and sent a script to Seinfeld and like other shows. And so at 11, I just thought, well, I can get a job there. So I do like that, but at least doing it professionally, it took took some time to start writing about movies and journalism and that, but I love that. So we were kind of precocious. Jen figured out the angles with reading, getting out of chores, and love of books. That's important, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool.
How
Did
did
they hire
you?
you at Seinfeld? Did they offer you a job?
I did receive a very polite, no thanks letter, like a letter, but they returned the script, and this is kind of, it's so embarrassing now, but they returned it. It's so dog-eared, and there's like coffee stains. So, this thing got like passed around the
Oh, and I think it's fabulous. I love it. I love it. I'm surprised it wasn't a Seinfeld episode. I think it's great.
I could totally see Larry David using
Yes. Yes.
that. Yes. I think the nicest was Barry Kemp. Back in the 80s, there was a show called Coach. I'm from Minnesota. Yeah, do you remember that? I wrote one of those, and Barry Kemp actually wrote a personal letter back and said, I didn't start writing until I was 17, so please write me back someday. Like, really sweet, which was nice.
That
But
is nice.
yeah. I wanted to know though, Jen, I know you write romance and mystery. Paige, how did you guys get into writing mysteries? Because I love the genre.
You could take a page.
There we go. Okay. Well, I s actually started off when all of this started that I wanted to take this writing seriously. I was in Salt Lake City, Utah, and the only writers group I could find was R Romance Writers of America. And
Oh,
so
nice.
I joined the local chapter, and it actually turned out to be one of the best things I've ever done. I mean, in that chapter at the time were Rayan Thane, let's see, Sherry Lewis is another one, and I'm drawing blanks on names, but anyway, there were some fabulous writers in that group, and something about the way it was set up really worked well for teaching me what I needed, some basics of writing and everything. But I couldn't write the romance genre. I hadn't read a lot of it. It didn't come naturally to me. But by that time, I'd read thousands, and I could be exaggerating, I've never kept count, of mysteries and thrillers and all of that. And so when I started to try down that road, I wouldn't say it was easier, but it became more natural. And I felt like I could see ahead a little bit instead of just, trying to keep coming up with euphemisms for sex that I couldn't, I was just not doing. It just wasn't happening. So I think that that's how I got into the mysteries, mostly because that's what I read growing up.
Yeah, for me, I am a genre queen. I'm rolling into my only book out next year is a fantasy. How crazy is
I
that?
love that. You're just, yeah, you're trying
I
new
know,
things.
and the weird thing is, it came out of novellas that I wrote that were rom-coms. I had this, it's I wrote these rom-com novellas about a museum of literature because book nerd. And then and they were just little novellas that I wanted to have put in audio, or there's a whole story behind that, and spite
Oh yeah, and self-publishing.
kind
I
of the
love
theme.
that story so much.
Yeah, it's my little spite story, but I won't bore you guys here with it. But the bottom line was, like Hallie Efren, is a friend of mine, and she always says, "Don't throw anything out." And she's so right, because this cozy fantasy that I'm writing came out of a rom-com, and the rom-coms, came out of being successful at the mysteries, because the first books I sold way back when were rom-coms for Harlequin, and then because I thought romance was easy. I'm like, it's two people getting together with a bunch of jokes. How hard can rom-coms be? Well, hard, because they have to be authentic and they have to have real emotional whatever. So for me, I like all genres, always have. So I wrote three rom-coms for Harlequin and essentially was fired. But in publishing, they never tell you you're fired. They always just say, this one doesn't fit, or this one's not quite right for us at this time. Because I
We're
kept
going a
sending,
different way.
yeah, we're going a different way. And that day it was, we're looking for, because right now they keep saying we want the same but different. But back then it was, I can't remember what it was that they were looking for, but it was one of those weird, like, little things that mean nothing but drive you completely crazy. And I couldn't. So anyway, so I was kind of unemployed. And then my husband said, well, you love mysteries. And he's a huge mystery, noir, suspense, thriller, all of them, reader. So he said, why don't you try mysteries? And I was just like, smart people write those. There's like, you know, a murder and red herrings. And that's entirely too hard. And then he's, you know, men, problem solvers, or they think they are. But yeah. He was just like, why don't you write it backwards?
Oh, okay.
It resonated because when I'd been writing the rom-coms, I had been a pantser writing by the seat of pants, which made it incredibly difficult. And then with mysteries, because I needed red herrings and suspects, mm-hmm. and I needed to know who did it and blah, blah, blah. Well, writing it backwards, you know, I kind of like was like, oh, you mean like have an outline? Have a map? Know where I'm going? What? But I did it and I started outlining. And at first I didn't follow the outline and then I'd get lost in the weeds and then I'd have to go back. Mm-hmm. But finally I kind of got my groove. And then, yeah, I started submitting mysteries and I didn't know what a cozy was. So the first mystery I submitted was, let me try to remember this. It took place. It was a woman who was divorced from a guy who owned a bunch of strip clubs and she had an exotic pet store with fish and birds. But she was still taking care of his fish because they were friends because he'd given her the money to open up her shop. But then she goes to his house to clean his fish tank and he's like face down in this massive fish.
Oh, wow.
Tank, and the fish are eating him. So not cozy. And my agent was like, I love your voice. And needless to say, we got rejected everywhere because nobody wanted a dead guy in a fish tank who owned strip clubs, I guess.
I would read it.
So I was right? That's kind of a bummer. So, but then, you know, we kept writing and submitting and... For me, my backdoor entry was they offered me a writer for hire. So I wrote my first cozy mystery series because I didn't know what cozy was under the name Lucy Lawrence. And it was a series about decoupage because crafting was super hot. And this editor had this idea and they were like, you know, will Jen write it? And I was at that point, I would have given them my first born. I was like, yes, I'll write it. So I did, but then I was smart enough, you know, I had a brief moment of shining brilliance because they don't happen often for me. But that one moment, I'm like, I don't think decoupage is really going to like be a hot ticket. So let's start looking, you know. So then I started pitching more and more ideas. And at one point I had like five different series going. So that was kind of how I jumped into mysteries. It was, you know, a lot of different factors kind of got me there.
Yeah, I'm amazed. You guys are so prolific. It's incredible. I'm just blown away when I was looking at your back catalog of books. So how long does it take you to write one and how do you juggle? Last week when Allison Galen was here, I was talking to her beforehand and she has another book of her own coming out soon, but she just released a new book for the Robert B. Parker series that she's writing. And she was saying that the Sunny books are kind of like a palate cleanser from the more psychological stuff that she does on her own. And so is it something like that where you can go from romance to mystery? Like, I need a break on that. Or do you write them simultaneously? Do you take breaks? How does that work?
For me, I kind of follow Stephen King's rule of it should take one season to write your first draft.
Okay.
So it usually takes about 3 months to write the first draft. So I do between 3 and 4 books a year usually. So I take, but you do, you're writing your first draft and then your revisions come in for another book and then your copy edits come in from another book and then you have to finish your draft and it's just like rinse repeat. So you're kind of always churning away at one book and then other things pop up to kind of, you know, but yeah, I do find switching genres is, for me, it's a nice break because the only thing is that's, with romance, it's hard because like a dead body in mysteries, you know, really moves the plot along.
Yeah.
Romance is hard. And then when I started writing the fantasy, what I like about it is there's like no rules. So it's like this one scene that was to me super boring. And I'm like, God, I'm just so bored. This should be more interesting. And all of a sudden I had ghost pirates in it. And I'm like, cool.
Oh my gosh. I love that. Yeah.
So that's kind of, yeah. So I'm really, if I could stay in all three genres, I'll be really happy.
Cool. How about you, Paige? Does it take a season? Do you go back and forth between like the Scottish bookshop mystery and an Alaska mystery? Or
I used to go back and forth. I used to write two books at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And why I did that. I have no idea why. It felt, I think it felt good to, you know, let the creative well fill up on another side. I don't know, but now I just do one book at a time, and every book now takes me about 4 months from beginning to end. A lot of it is, and believe it or not, a lot of it is something I learned from Jen years ago. She used the word momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that really resonated with me. So when I sat down and I'm like, I just have to keep the momentum, yeah. You know, I have to keep the momentum going. And once I figured that out, it really kind of, it moved along a lot faster. It used to take me 9 months to write a book, and now it takes me about four.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. Are you a plotter, a pantser?
A hamster. Yeah. Okay. Totally.
That is amazing. And mystery. I'm like, I would I have know. To like, oh my God.
I know. Yeah. I know. Paige and I have long conversations. I'm like, how, why? Why would you do that too? But you know, I get it. I think we're both friends with Reese Bowen, and she says she's a pantser and she does historicals. Wow. So I'm like, but and I think Paige feels this way too. Mm-hmm. You would be bored if you had an outline. Like, you would already know what's going to happen and you'd be bored.
Yeah.
But I have a horrible sense of direction, so I need an outline or I'm lost.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that is true. Yeah, because I was looking at, I said this off air to both of them, but I picked up a couple of their books, and I know my mom has read a million others, so I'm going to have to go like raid her collection as well. Deadly Editions is the one I have by Paige Shelton, and then Love at First Book by Jen McKinley. And Paige, when I was reading the back of this, I was just in love with the plot line, and it reminded me, it's like a treasure hunt, and it reminded me a little bit of, have you guys seen the movie The Last of Sheila at all?
I have not.
Ooh, okay, write that one down. You will love it. But it's set in the 70s, and it was actually co-written by Sondheim and Anthony Perkins. They loved throwing these mystery parties, and so they wrote like a treasure hunt, like a mystery thing, but it has Hollywood players, different, like an actor, a director, everybody has a secret, and then it's, is this kind of this game they're playing? Are they revealing who killed Sheila? It's in the, you know, the title of the film, sorry, The Last of Sheila, Sheila Dies. They're like, thanks, Jen. But no, it's the beginning of the movie, so it's okay. But yeah, I think you guys will love that. But I'm just blown away. I love this idea so much. So I'm very excited to read this one. How do you come up with these plots is what I want to know, Paige, because, you know, like, especially when you're a pantser, you're writing about treasure hunts and character. It's like, I'm just blown away. How do you do that?
Well, thank you, first of all, for reading it. I appreciate that a lot. It's a spark. I start everything with a tiny spark of something. And with that book, it was quite simply a treasure hunt. That was it. And so then I have the city of Edinburgh, and I have the characters, you know, to use and to create that hunt and to create kind of an adventure where, you know, within the book, you can learn more about the characters, as well as hopefully a little bit more about Edinburgh. I love bringing the city into the books, even though the bookshop is fictional and doesn't exist there. I like to still bring some authentic things into it. So a spark with that was Treasure Hunt. The book coming out at the end of this year, the Alaska book, the spark was between Jen and another young woman, Kate Carlisle, that we have a plot group.
Oh, yeah.
I said, I just need a spark. I need something. And one of them said, how about Bigfoot? Okay.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
So while it's not the typical Bigfoot that you might expect, what that did is that sparked off something to get me started and toward a story. So for me, it's a spark.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. And Jen, the book I have, Love at First Book, we were talking, you took a little tour with your mom and your friend around Ireland, the Ring of Kerry. And I know you have books that are set in other places. So how much travel do you guys get to write off? How do you write about places you've never been? Like, how are you doing this? Especially during the pandemic, I remember talking to Susan Elia McNeil, and she couldn't go and dig through some of the research or go to these places. And so I'm just wondering, how do you do that? You write about these faraway lands, and you know, is your accountant like, we're writing that off? Or
I mean,
very
it's
cool
for me. I always try. I always, when I write about like the one set in the Outer Banks, I'll be going to the Outer Banks to do the boots on the ground, because there's certain things like just the way a place smells, you know, how the people talk. And when I was writing, I wrote a London hat shop series for a while. So I brought my mom and my sons over when they were much younger, and we, you know, stomped around London for like, you know, 2 weeks. And there was just so many just little things that you don't know unless you're actually standing there. Like, what is the, what's it like going down into the tube? What's, you know, is there a north? I didn't know there was a north and a south platform, and that you have to know which one. And, you know, just always mind the gap, and, you know, all these things that you just, you have to know. So I can't imagine writing about a place I haven't been to. And for me, I pick places so that I can travel.
I
wanted to go to Ireland. So it was like, and the one before it was set in Martha's Vineyard, which I grew up in New England, so I had been to Martha's Vineyard a million times, but it was really nice to go back and do the research. And then the character in Love at First Book is in Summer Reading. So in Summer Reading, you kind of know she's looking to get out, you know, so it's like set up. So it was pretty natural just to follow her. But
yeah,
I need to write it all off, every bit.
You know, these are all so picturesque, the places they take, you know, that your settings you're using. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking about like the Hallmark movies that now are, you know, filmed all over the world. And I'm like, guys, get Paige and Jen's books, you know, and let's bring them to the TV and let's do it. I'll be your agent for that kind of thing. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
But yeah, let's get it done. We're going to sign a petition. We want to see these on the big screen. Absolutely.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Me too.
What is the most common misconception you hear about cozy mysteries and or romance books? Because I know some people write off both genres. People tend to do that. I had about 15 years as a professional film critic, so that was kind of commonplace among some of my colleagues for romances or women's pictures. They're using the old 50s term. Sometimes they're chick flicks, and there's no equivalent for the male. I mean, dude movies or something, or guy movies, but we don't really say that. So what is the most common misconception for your genres?
I think that they're formula. You always hear, oh, it's just a formula. It's just a formula. It's like, well, you know.
Try it. Yeah.
Everything's. I mean, those dude movies are a formula.
Yeah,
it's like 5 minutes in and there's a car chase or somebody blew up. You know what I mean? And that's okay. I love those movies.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I just want stuff to blow up every 5 minutes because I'm in that kind of So I get it, you know. But I think, yeah, a lot of it's formula. But and it's interesting because I'm going to slide into our movies a little bit. When I was rewatching Desk Set, and, you know, it's this massive computer coming in, Miss Emmy, because it's the 50s. And I was thinking, we're kind of, it's like, it still resonates because now it's AI.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Know what I mean? I'm like, how weird that this movie written so long ago is still applicable. But I think, for me, when people say either genre is a formula, it's like there's always going to be writers in a genre that are, how do I say this nicely? Not good.
Oh, yeah.
They're just not good. Their characters are two-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Their plots are predictable. That exists in all genres. Literary genre. I mean, literature can be the most boring stuff ever, which is why I'm a genre girl. But for it to be, when you say it's a formula, though, it's not, you can't just take a man and a woman and stick them in the exact same, you know.
No.
We kind of hurt ourselves because we'll be like, well, the tropes, you know. It's like when I got into writing cozies, it was like decoupage crafts were hot, so they gave me a weird one. And then it was like food was popular, so then I was writing about a cupcake bakery, and then books were hot, so then there was a library mystery. So, I mean, we kind of do it to ourselves, but I think, you know, when Paige and I started, there was a ton of us. There was a lot of us traditionally published. And now there's just not that many traditionally published.
Yeah, it's getting harder.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is indie authors have started writing. And I'm not saying that they're not good, but they're not going through the same process we have to go through. Like, you know, a lot of them.
Yeah. I'm sure some
professional and higher editors and they're good and everything. But a lot of them, it's, you know, I've read ones where I'm like, oof, you.
Yeah. By page three, you're like, okay, nobody proofread this. This is not
what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So, and I definitely don't want to dismiss anybody because
oh, if no, you're an
indie
all.
Author, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
But I think that's the number one thing. People think it's a formula, but any book is really the author's voice. You know what I mean? It's like, I think every author has a very original and distinctive voice. And that's why, in my opinion, AI, and I don't care if they're saying it's getting better and better and better, and it'll be able to imitate you and blah, 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 blah.
No.
It won't have the soul. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It won't have, I mean, every single book I write, I've noticed, will reference whatever I'm going on in my life at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And AI isn't going to be able to do that. So
not at all.
I think that's the number one thing that people say. But then my response would always be like, oh, goody, write one. Get back to me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yes. How about you, Paige, for cozies?
I think that in mysteries and in cozy mysteries in particular, well, not all mysteries, but in cozy mysteries in particular, I think people forget there's a murder.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a mystery with the, you know, graphic stuff off the page or behind a door mm-hmm. or what have you, but there's still a murder, you know, there's still something that needs to be solved. I think people sometimes think the cozy mysteries are just a cozy, fun little story. Well, they are fun and they are good stories, but there's mm-hmm. also a murder that needs to be solved. And sometimes I think that that's forgotten.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think being a good librarian, a bookseller, researcher, and writer, of course, has a lot in common with being a good detective, because you have to be interested in getting to the bottom of things. You need that sense of curiosity, a doggedness to sleuth out answers. And it does, as Jen was pointing out, go very well with the first movie, Desk Set. Director Walter Lang's 1957 Tracy and Hepburn rom-com, which screenwriters Phoebe and Henry Efron, as in Nora Ephron's parents, adapted from William Marchant's titular play written 2 years earlier. Tracy is an efficiency expert who has invented a computer meant to replace reference librarians at the Federal Broadcasting Network in a department headed up by Katharine Hepburn. It's a delightful, still, as Jen was pointing out, very timely rom-com. I love watching it around the holidays, but it was really cool to see. It was actually on TCM as we're recording this last night. And in Ben Mankiewicz's introduction, he was talking about AI, and he also made a joke. He said, Emmy, the computer in the movie, is the size of a cyber truck and about as attractive, which I thought was perfect. Yes. So I love this movie. And Jen, it was your first time. Paige, you know, Paige, have you been a fan for a long time? When did you see this one?
When I was a little girl, my grandparents lived in a little town in Missouri. And for a reason I really don't understand, they lived in this little old teeny tiny house, and they had a big old TV, you know, console TV. and they had only a window air conditioner in that front room. And so I would couch because it was so hot during the summer months.
Humid.
But I would turn on the TV and I would watch all the old movies at night, and I'd watch them all night. And I remember seeing this movie. I couldn't tell you, probably when I was 9 or 10, maybe. Mm-hmm. But you know, those were the days when I was like, Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. And I had no idea when I was watching them that these were old movies at the time, and these were older people at the time. Yeah. And you know, my heart went out to all these people I saw, To Kill a Mockingbird, then to, not to go down that road, but I saw all these characters, and I saw the Hepburn and the Tracy, and then later learned that they were in real life, you know, partners in real life. And, mm-hmm. and it was just a wonderful thing to immerse yourself into that whole entire world, you know, overnight. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I had seen it before. It's one of my favorites, but 84 Charing Cross Road is the one.
That's the one.
Right. Yeah. But I did know. And oh my God, I can't believe I missed it. But Desk Set, I think I saw as a teenager. And, you know, I was already a library nerd. So it was just like, but I grew up in Connecticut, and Katharine Hepburn lived in Connecticut, and my uncle lived like literally down the street from her.
Oh, wow.
So I was an uber Katharine Hepburn fan always.
Yeah. Always. And as you were pointing out, she and Spencer Tracy were involved from, I want to say, the mid to late 30s onward. This was their eighth film together. Their ninth and final was like 10 years later, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And when this movie was, when they were first trying to put it together, there was something interesting where Spencer Tracy was like, who's going to want to see us old? And who's going to want to see us in color? Because this was their first film. And as Ben Mankiewicz, who was a past guest on the show, but as he pointed out last night, he's like, people who love movies want to see you. And, you know, that's exactly what this movie, you know, proved, is we're going to watch great people going through it. And it is amazing that this was originally written in 1955, the play. Now, it was different, I guess, the interactions between the efficiency expert and Bunny Watson, the research librarian she plays, were kind of limited, I guess, in the play. I haven't read it. And so the Efrons kind of tailor-made it for Hepburn and Tracy and, you know, beefed up the romance a little bit. There's so much good stuff that harks back, Jen, to that Katharine Hepburn that we love so much from the Screwball era. Like, my favorite scene in the movie is when he takes her up for lunch and they're like freezing on top of the roof and he's giving her like a pop quiz of the weirdest trivia questions and just how her brain works. It's incredible. Right. Yeah.
No. And it's, you know, it's so funny. Those things resonate in the opening of Love at First Book. She's taken a job as she's a librarian. She's working in a bookstore and the bookstore owner is pop quizzing her. And she's just in her head thinking, like, I was a librarian. Like, is this for real? Like, I don't even know I was a librarian. But I think it's, you know, I'm sure seeing desks set, you know, multiple times over my life, it like popped right in there into the room. You know what I mean? Because everything's derivative.
Yeah, sometimes we don't even know where we're getting these ideas. Yeah. And Paige, I know you love this one. So you watched it as a girl. Did it kind of tap right into your love of libraries, science, and books and words, do you think?
It did a few things. It made me think she should be on Jeopardy, number one.
Yes, right? Oh my God.
So I thought, oh, I loved how they made her brilliant. I loved how they did that. I thought that was absolutely spectacular. I loved how they made Spencer Tracy not as brilliant. I thought that was just smart, fabulous. Yeah. You know, of course he was behind the computer and all that kind of stuff, but I loved how they gave her the shining role of brilliance as well as the shining role of fun. And as all of that, I thought that was, I thought that was pretty fabulous what they did. And seeing it this time around, I made my husband sit and watch it with me. And I thought, he's going to get up and go do something else any minute.
Oh, that's good.
And he's like, oh, that was good. And he said, so that was written by Nora Ephron's dad? And I said, yes. And he said, I can see the ties to Nora Ephron. And I'm like, yes. Really? Good job. So it was so fun. Good. It was interesting. Him to it. He'd never seen, I mean, he never watched old movies or anything like that when he was younger or even now. And so it was fun to introduce him to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you pick up anything this time, Jen, that you maybe hadn't earlier? I mean, sometimes when we've seen movies a million times, yeah, they kind of just wash over us. And then other times certain things resonate. Like for me watching it this time, the Gig Young subplot, she's been involved with this guy for seven years, not having the time of day or kind of treating her like a doormat. Like that was interesting as a woman in my early 40s. And it's like, oh, I've known guys like that. And some of my friends have dealt with similar issues. And I also loved the relationship and the interplay with the women in the office. Joan Blondell, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it was very forward thinking. I mean, you can tell just from, I do a blog with Hallie Efron.
Oh, wow.
And from what she's told me about her family, because she'll talk about growing up as an Efron. I mean, she never planned to be a writer, which is kind of hilarious because she's written like the best how to write a mystery books on out there. But she'll talk about her mom, you know, complicated relationship. I don't think she'll care if I mention it, but her mother was very proud of the fact that she didn't cook. Like they had a cook, like her mother just, you know, so when I looked, so knowing Hallie and seeing what her parents wrote, you know, it's like I feel like I know Phoebe Efron a little bit better because I think the strong female character, Bunny is Phoebe, or there's a very strong, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
And when you're pointing that out too, like when he comes in and the really cute scene where she has to pull out a robe from the Christmas presents to give to him, and they're asking about like, how do you like to cook chicken? And he explains it, which now that I'm hearing about the cooking, that's interesting.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to writers writing like little bits of ourselves, whether we realize it or not, are in everything we write. You know, ourselves or people that we care about or our inner circle, or, you know, you can't help it.
No.
We always joke, everything's material, you know.
Yeah. John Cassavetes used to record like conversations around with Jenna Rollins, and it was driving her nuts sometimes. It's like, you can't use this, but writers will use everything. Good friends of mine, Jordan Harper and Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, they'll joke when I'll tell a story like, I'm going to use that, Jen. If you don't use that, it's like, yeah, then you have to watch it. Like last week, I told Allison Galen this hilarious thing that happened last month in L.A. I brought my mom with me to a hotel and we had kind of a sitcom experience going on in the hotel. She's like, if you don't write that, I'm putting that in a book.
No, it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also a beautiful looking movie. This was shot by one of the cinematographers, I think, who holds the most Academy Award nominations, Leon Shamroy. So it's beautiful. It's in CinemaScope, the colors. What did you think of the characters and the friendships between the women, Paige?
Well, I love the friendships between the women. From this perspective of not being a younger girl watching it any longer, I remember thinking, Spencer Tracy, what is so appealing about him for Miss Katharine Hepburn, who, of course, I idolized and loved. Fabulous. But this time around, I was like, oh my gosh, they're perfect. You know, see from this adult perspective and you see the chemistry and you don't see, you see beyond the, I guess, the age of everybody, and you see the douchebag, you know, of the other guy. And things become more clear, and the women's friendships and the women's intelligence. It just ticked all the boxes. It was just fantastic.
Yeah. It reminded me of like my favorite line in Something's Gotta Give, which I always say, like, no, I'm sorry, Diane Keaton, you should have ended up with Keanu Reeves at the end. But Keanu Reeves has this great line where he's like, how great is it for you that I'm not intimidated by your brilliance or something like that, or your intelligence? And it's like, oh my God, like he actually read what she was writing. Sometimes, you know, guys don't do that or whatever. And watching it this time, I was thinking about how Spencer Tracy just looks at her. And his character is not intimidated by her. I mean, he's marveling, but he's fascinated, and he really respects her, and he doesn't like mansplain anything. And also, you know, he isn't intimidated. I love like the scene I was talking about on the roof when he's watching her, just the way, like, you know, the eyes crinkle and sparkle. And I have actor friends, and they're like, you can always tell when someone is laughing in character, or if they're actually laughing and enjoying themselves. And you can really see that these two people were.
I love that. I love that.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So anything else about this movie before we move on?
I wish we all dressed like that.
I know, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Christmas party scene, it's just like I could just watch the costumes and the dresses. And
that iridescent purple one her coworker was wearing. I was like, can someone make that?
You know, and I'm not a girly, like, I am not a girly girl. You know? Like, I showered today. You're welcome. But I don't know. There's just like, and when Paige was saying she used to watch the old movies, when I had my biggest breakup of breakups, and I was finally living by myself, 2 a.m., you know, you're not sleeping because, you know, but I was watching all the old, like, I think one of the few channels I got was AMC.
Okay.
So it was Carmen Miranda movies, and just, you know, they did so many movies that were about, like, it was so meta back then. It was like they were doing movies about making movies, you know?
Yes.
So big sets and dancing and singing and Fred Astaire. I mean, it was kind of crazy in a way. But I think everybody was kind of in love with Hollywood and being a star. So that's what they did their movies about. forgot my point, but
but the way they look and
I
the
miss
beauty.
That, like, I don't know. I mean, I just miss
beauty and opulence and, you know,
And I'm not someone who's swayed by, like, you know, money, or because we're writers, so money means nothing. You know what I mean?
I'm a freelance writer. That means broke.
Exactly. We're poor people. We're okay with that. But it's kind of like, it's a little off topic, but it's like to shove my point, you know, to beat it to death, kind of like air travel. When I first flew in a plane, it was the 80s.
Oh, and it was glamorous. Yeah.
It was very glamorous. You would not roll in your pajamas. Do you know what I mean? Dressed up to be on the plane. I mean, granted, it was early 80s and I was younger, way younger, like a kid. But you still had to show up looking a certain way, you know? And then your meal was like silverware and real plates. And it was, you know, it may not have been awesome, but it was like real, you know? And now it's like, buy your own food, wear your pajamas. Everybody's got their hoodie on. Nobody talks to anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I guess I just kind of missed that in a way, you know? So, and when I was watching it, I was like, oh, when I was a kid, I used to watch, you know, the parents' cocktail parties.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like hippie 70s, you know, bell bottoms and big hair and stuff and whatever. But it still had that vibe. Do you know what I mean? So anyway, that's what really hit me with that movie. It's like, I kind of miss the glamour.
I know. Yeah, I agree with you. It's so beautiful. And you do kind of miss that idea of, you know, dressing up and just the presentation and what you were saying about they did make a lot of movies about movie making. Now, I mean, the joke is that every movie is really about Hollywood or really about the creative process or movie making, but like in an allegorical way.
Right.
But back then it was like, nope, we're going to be overt. We're just going to, you know, we're going to go for it. Like there is a 10-minute ballet that in one of the best movies of all time, you know, Singing in the Rain, and then one in American in Paris. That has really nothing to do with the plot. It's, you know, Sid Charisse is in the one and singing the, she's not in the rest of the movie. Nobody cares. It's just beautiful.
Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Just dance, be pretty, wear the gorgeous dress. We're good.
Yes. You're good there. And made 30 years later in 1987, director David Jones's 84 Charing Cross Road, starring Anne Bancroft and Anthony Hopkins, was written by Hugh Whitemore, based on James Roose Evans' play, which was adapted by Helene Hamp's epistolary 1970 memoir, taken from the letters that the bibliophile, Anglophile, and writer wrote to Frank Dole at a bookshop in England from where she lived in New York from 1949 to 1968. I am a sucker for anything having to do with writing letters. I miss letter writing. I still write letters. I write emails that are way too long. And it was terrifying. Susan Elia McNeil told me that she read that people don't actually read past the first paragraph. And it broke my heart. I'm like, I write like five paragraphs. These are, you know, I'm funny. I'm pithy. I'm like, you know, I work hard on these emails. Are you kidding me? And she's like, no, I love emails too. And so I love this idea of writing letters. This is a film. I also, I think I saw it right before the pandemic or maybe at the beginning. So it was kind of like, oh, I miss this idea and people and connections. So I know this is the one I had it backwards, Jen, that you just saw. So what did you think of this one?
I think, you know, it's like a bibliophile. It's the epitome of cozy. not to abuse that, but it was everything a cozy person would. I mean, you know, when she's opening up the package and it's a leather bound book and she's just, and it's, yeah, I was just like, oh, I get you. I loved how very different they were. You know, she's this brusque New Yorker and he's this, you know.
Yeah. She's
and
really
I love
blunt.
He's always trying to chip into there, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, because I read up on it a little bit, I didn't realize that her husband, Mel Brooks, bought the rights of the movie to give to her. So it was just, that just kind of added a layer of, oh, because I love Mel Brooks. But, you know, so yeah, I just, to me, it was just, it's like a grilled cheese sandwich, you know, comfort. It was pure comfort. I just loved it. Loved it.
Loved it. Yeah. Comfort movie. And Paige, I know, like me, you hadn't seen it in a while. So what was it like revisiting it?
You know, it held up so well. I think that was the first thing that struck me. Well, of both of the older movies, they both to me held up really well. I mean, of course, there's time things that the times are different, but this movie, you know, it touches your heart in ways, and it just makes you want to be a part of that world. It's if somebody asks me what made you want to be a writer, and I had forgotten this, but that movie would have contributed to the answer. You know, Anne Bancroft in her little apartment over her typewriter with her cigarettes and her drinks, and I don't smoke and I don't drink, but I don't care. And I work on a computer, but that whole image is part of what I wanted to be and what I wanted to become. And her personality, which of course is based on Helen herself, was so fabulous. I mean, it was just, she was, pardon the language, but she was one ballsy lady. And yeah. I just loved every bit of her. And I thought, and again, this was one I made my husband watch with me, and I'm going to give him a little credit right now. He said, that's the original You've Got Mail, which is the one we're going to talk about in a little bit. And I thought, oh, pretty good insight. Nice work.
Well done, Charlie.
Very good. And I mean,
it absolutely held up and actually touched my heart. And I'm like, now just be prepared. The ending isn't what you expect and everything. Mm-hmm. Give it away.
No, you can't. No spoilers, but yeah, I feel you.
Yeah, you did it to me again, and I knew it was coming. So no, it was absolutely fabulous. I loved every second of it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but when I was watching this, thinking about Anthony Hopkins holding books, and you know, my favorite scene I think he ever did, and I love his work, but is in Remains of the Day when he's reading a love story and he's like kind of holding it to his chest and she's teasing him and she like has realized she's touched a nerve, and it's really a confession of love scene without actually saying the words, which is always a little more interesting. Like Billy Wilder used to say, you don't have the characters say I love you. They say something else, like ditto or shut up and deal or something like that.
Right.
And that's better. And so I was thinking of The Remains of the Day and then also Shadowlands. So between like 87 and 93, 94, he was kind of like seducing all of us, making us swoon with books, essentially. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. I know. I really love the scene where he hears an American in the store.
Yes.
Yeah. He's in the doorway. And then when he goes back to his office and he's, you know, it's Yates, it's like, oh, it's just so smart and so wordy and lovely. And yeah, he kind of breaks my heart now. Yeah. And he broke my heart Remains of the Day. It's funny that you mentioned
yes.
that. Like,
I know.
Oh, Anthony, you bastard.
We're getting you back, Anthony. No. It's really good. And I think, you know, like you were saying, A Woman Over the Typewriter, I remember growing up with like Murder, She Wrote, it was always on after 60 minutes. So you'd hear like the tick, 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 and then you'd see her at her typewriter like right away. And so I don't know, it's almost like a typing noise and then her. And I love this idea of she got to know everything and just kind of like be there, and she was pleasant and kind of the original cozy, I guess. But yeah, mm-hmm. this idea of being a writer was kind of just mixed in with being a detective, and who doesn't love that? But yeah, Anne Bancroft's character in this, she's brash and she says some shocking things at times. And you think, is that going to hit over in England? Like, what would they imagine her sense of humor? Like, are they going to be insulted? But she just trusts it. I also love that we have Judi Dench as the wife. You have Mercedes mm-hmm. Rule in a tiny role. I guess J. Smith Cameron in a tiny role. So these
people yeah. who... It was a stellar cast. It was really cool.
Absolutely. No, this is a good one. I think you can kind of, I don't know what your husband's taste in books is, but I think you can kind of figure a man out by like what he likes to read. I'm not saying I interrogate, but I kind of do. Like, oh, what are your favorite books? You know? Yeah. Just make sure a couple of the... Okay. Yeah.
You want to make sure they like. If you meet someone who reads stuff that you're just like, you kind of go in with judgment. I'm just going to say.
Yes.
But exactly. If you meet someone who loves the same thing, it's like Insta Best Friends. I mean, I know they joke about it, but you know, if they read the same things, like Paige and I'll recommend books to each other. And you know, sometimes we like it and sometimes I'm like, what was she thinking? And the other times I'm like, oh my God, she's right. This is brilliant. I forget the one that you told me to read. Oh, What was it, Beautiful Creatures? Was that one of the ones?
Maybe.
I think so. That was one of the ones where I was like, oh, Paige is on it. That was good. That's really good.
It was good.
Yeah. I think that would be one of the best things. It is at least my circle. We don't stop talking about books that we read. I house sat for Jordan Harper the song. I'm like, I don't even need to bring a book with me. I'll just go raid his office and just go, you know, start reading all the books. And so I'm like, ah, The Galton Case. I've never read that, and just grabbed it off the shelf. And so that was really fun. I think, you know, this also just the love of owning books. You know, I'm kind of, yes, this is an audio podcast. Everyone's going to be like, what is she talking about? There's books behind all of us right now. And it's probably, this is a fraction of the amount of books in our houses, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I picked up a bookmark at the Burbank Airport on my way back from LA. I was introducing a movie last month there. And on the way back, I saw one that said, it isn't hoarding if it's books. And I'm like, got to get that.
Yeah.
I know, we almost need to like hang up a sign or something. But yeah,
it's a rule.
Yeah.
When my husband and I got married, because he's a musician and I'm a writer, so yeah, that's our, you know, socioeconomic artist poverty.
Yes.
But we always promised each other that there would always be money for books. That was kind of our one thing going in. And then of course we had children, and then, you know,
yeah,
luckily we're both librarians, so that was helpful. But yeah, it was like, that was
nice.
Our one. There's always money for books.
That's yeah. Now, did your kids and Paige too, do they love books and writing, and have they followed in your footsteps at all?
Well, my son loves to read. He absolutely loves, he's always read and everything.
That's good.
He loves to read. And so that's been fun. They read. So they did have their second child. So now I have two grandbabies. I'm going to go see him next week.
Congratulations.
But anyway. Thank
so exciting.
You.
Hope everyone's happy and
everybody's healthy
and
everybody's
doing well.
Doing great. But every night they read a book to their little one, just like we did with him. And so it's like Jen was saying, you know, it's a family tradition and it carries on and it continues on. But I think my son, as far as writing, would be more of, he's more of a math person. So if it's computer programming, maybe, but
wow.
Not word.
Yeah. That's an important skill. Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need our masks.
Yeah,
one of my sons is graduating from the film school at ASU next year.
Oh, nice.
So, and he took, he dabbled with screenwriting. He was like, oh, I think I'm born of a writer. I'll be a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And then he took the class and he was like, nope. He's like, that's really hard. But we'll have really amazing conversations about film. And, you know, he's got his showcase coming up in December. So I'm really excited to see he's mostly into the sound aspects of filmmaking.
That's important. Wow.
Well, as his professor said, he's like, so you'll be employed.
So, yes. Yeah. Visual effects, sound, all of the, you know,
so
those are really important technical skills.
Yeah. And then the other one is a health major. But they're both, what's really interesting to me is they're both readers, but what's really weird to me is they read nonfiction. Like they'll read a little bit of fiction, and it could be because they're both at university, but, number two, it reads a lot of memoirs, athletes, people like that. And then the other one, it's all film. He reads a lot of biographies of filmmakers, you know, so it's just kind of funny. And I'm like, well, are you ever going to read fiction again?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, you know, maybe someday. So I think, I know a lot of people kind of dip out of reading in their 20s. And I think it's, you're establishing your career, you're busy with friends, you know. And then I've noticed, like, even friends that I had when I was younger that were not readers, now, you know,
yep,
we're all in our golden years or approaching the golden years, and they all read, every single one of them. It's like, oh, I have to read before I go to bed or I can't sleep. I have to, and I can't be watching, I can't be on a screen. I have to read a
book.
It just, you know, quiets their brain down or whatever. And I'm just like, I think that's so hilarious. And my dad was a notorious non-reader until he was like, in his 50s. And then all of a sudden he was constantly reading. And I was like, who are you?
Yeah, it's funny when that happens. I think my dad, you know, worked with his hands, loved being outside. My mom was the museum, library, that kind of, and my dad was not. And then after they split, he decided, like, okay, I got to get back out there. And they're both like so much happier and they're great people. But my dad, so he went to Barnes and Noble and he said, you know what? I thought this is a good way to meet women. And so he asked around and he's like, what is the most popular book? And it was the Da Vinci Code at the time. He said that book helped him just, it also just helped him have courage to like talk to people because he'd bring it out to restaurants and bars and people would talk and stuff. And he's like, and that worked. And now, I mean, he always enjoyed kind of like listening to audiobooks, but now he's slowly getting into it a little bit. My brother, same thing. He's getting back into reading after years. So I think what you're saying is cyclical, but I did want to backtrack on your son at ASU. That's wonderful with film. Don't let him get too, I love that he's in sound. That's important. Screenwriting classes, though, kind of suck notoriously. Like I took one, and I mean, I love the, she's still a friend of mine, the professor. I was like one of three women in the class. And so when you had to read work out loud, you had to read a part. And so I had to play all the wives and girlfriends. And basically my job was, oh, honey, you know, you're spending too much time at work. It was always nagging or like, or else being too easy or too naggy and that kind of. So what I'm saying is like, screenwriting classes are terrible.
He would agree. I think, well, it was fun. We were talking about it today because, you know, they are getting ready for their showcase and whatnot. So he was telling me, like, this is my film. And, you know, mm-hmm. and we were talking about how the script is the foundation.
Yeah.
And without a really strong script, he said, you know, because his sound is, he does, you know, production sound, but he does post-production sound. He's like, I can't save your film in post-production if you didn't start with a really strong foundation. And I know he's probably biased because, you know, he lives with, or he did live with a writer. But, and he watched, you know, but I always felt that way. Like I remember back in the way back when the writers in Hollywood had their first strike and a lot of people were like kind of nasty about it. And I was just like, you don't have anything without the writers. So back up, you know, and people are like, why don't you care about the Oscars? And I'm like, they didn't write the movie. You know, it's like very clear that the writers didn't even get that much. Now I feel like they get a lot more acknowledgement. But back in the day, like growing up, I never remembered who wrote.
No, not at all.
They never got acknowledged. They were never in the awards show. So I'm like, to me, it's the whole cornerstone of whatever you're building, you know? Mm-hmm. But I could be biased. We might be biased. But
three women that love to write. And of course, when you're talking about loving to write and the people behind creative ideas and film, Nora Ephron, I share a birthday with her. She was always one of my favorites. I think one of my earliest memories was my brother and I not being able to fall asleep because our parents were downstairs laughing uproariously at When Harry Met Sally. And so then I like sneak down and I watch, you know, I didn't understand half the jokes, but I loved that, a ton growing up. And then, finding out she wrote My Blue Heaven, which is one of my favorite stories. I'm sure you've probably heard Hallie tell you this story, but, when she was with Nicholas Pileggi, when he was working on Goodfellas, Henry Hill, the real Henry Hill would call when he was like half in the bag. And and sometimes sometimes legitimately Pileggi was sleeping, but other times, so she would answer the phone and she'd just start asking questions because she's very, you know, she was a journalist. Just start asking questions about the mob and this and his attitudes. He had no idea that she was writing My Blue Heaven, which came out the same year as Goodfellas. They're both about the same guy. And I don't think he made the comment. He said, anybody else's wife. And you're like, whoa. Yes. So I always loved her and her movies. And You've Got Mail is a film I know we all love. So I would be curious to know, has Hallie talked about this one? And I know it's based on, of course, the play Perfumery, which became Shop Around the Corner in the Good Old Summertime. There's that musical She Loves Me, which is a lot of fun, but also they're taken from Pride and Prejudice. So, you know, is this one you guys remember seeing like right away in the theater?
I have not talked about this one with Hallie. Yeah. I'm a When Harry Met Sally girl. That's like,
I love that movie.
That is my favorite. Nora movie of all time.
Bruno Kirby. I don't know about you, but like I would have gone for Bruno Kirby in that.
Totally. Like what? You know? Yeah. But I love Carrie Fisher so much. I mean,
oh
it was
my
just
God.
Like,
yes.
The wedding dressing, you know. Okay. Yeah. We can I could do a whole podcast on When Harry Met Sally.
Next time. Wagon wheel coffee table. Yeah.
Put a pin in it. But for You've Got Mail, this is so funny. It came out in 98. And for some reason, I didn't see it in the theater, which is kind of surprising. But my husband and I were on our honeymoon in Hawaii, and it came on, like, you know, the Cinemax HBO thing. So I first saw You Got Mail in Lahaina, in Maui.
Oh, wow.
because the reason is, and it's kind of a romantic comedy thing, we're from Arizona. So mm-hmm. we flew to Hawaii, you know, and we bought a house like 2 weeks before we got married. Everybody came in for the wedding. I mean, it was just like, I think we got to Hawaii and slept for 14 hours. I mean, we were just.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we got up and we went down and had our bathing suits on because we're in Hawaii. And our waitress was so cute. She was, you know, from California or whatever. Cute little thing. And she was like, okay, I don't even want you guys to leave the hotel without like 75 SPF. Like, you know, seriously, this mm-hmm. is not. I know you think you're from Arizona and I think you know heat and blah, 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 but you know. And we were like, oh, yeah. And we didn't. And we went out and I think we sat outside for 2 hours, no sunscreen, like idiots. So
oh
we spent half of our honeymoon like, yeah, don't touch me. And you're making a lot of heat, so you need to move.
Yeah.
So we turned on the TV and we're like, what can we watch? And You've Got Mail. But I remember just having a scorching sunburn.
Oh, wow.
Watching You Got Mail.
Yeah.
And I'm like, on our honeymoon. That's genius. But yeah.
That's in the Heartbreak Kid. She gets sunburned. Yeah.
Yep. I know. I can't use it, but it's hard to keep it done.
You can. I mean, it's coming for real.
Though.
Paige, do you remember seeing this one when it came out?
You know, it's so funny. I don't remember seeing it in the theater. My guess is I did, but I was also raising a kid at the time. He was pretty. So maybe I didn't, but what I remember is when it was on all the TV channels all the time. And so I know I had already seen it. So I must have seen it in the theater, but it's one of those movies that I always stop on, you know, when I was searching on TV, you know, for something to watch or whatever. So I had seen it bits and pieces for years and finally watched the whole thing again or something. I can't quite remember. It just always, how could you look away? I can't look away from Meg or Tom or any of the other characters. It's just impossible to look away from that movie. It just draws your mind, right?
Yeah. The supporting players. I love every character in this movie. You know, Parker Posey described as she makes coffee nervous, which is really
great. The elevator scene.
The elevator scene is so good. Greg Kinnear.
I love Greg Kinnear.
He's one of my favorites. Yeah. And of course, I think Heather Burns, who is also in 2 Weeks Notice. She's the other bookseller.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Steve Zahn is, I love Steve Zahn very much.
I do too.
I think he's good. Dabney Coleman. I think, you know, it's hard to like pick a favorite line read because there are so many quotable ones.
Yeah.
But after he passed away, I'm like, this is probably a dumb thing to say. But I said, you know what my favorite was is in You've Got Mail, because he's in a movie with all of these scene stealers, is the nanny. His line read is so good. And so I just shared him like in that moment, he's just the funniest person in the movie. And it was cool because Ben Stiller saw that and he went, yes. And so it's good that other people just appreciated like everybody in the whole thing. I think like, you know, just people who walk in and have two lines are good. The little girl,
mm-hmm.
good, you know,
yeah.
And then the other kid, like, I'm his brother. So
totally. You know, what's funny is when I'm thinking about it, it's like there's in each one of these movies, there is a brilliant ensemble cast.
True. Good
like
point.
They're all so well cast. So it's not just that you're attached to the office girls in Desk Set. You're attached to the bookstore workers in Charing Cross. And you're attached to... same thing, bookstore people, but also, you know, Joe Fox's entourage of people too. So it's I really feel like for me, books and movies that I love are always groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think dialing all the way back to why cozies are or the unique thing about them is you usually always have a really strong ensemble cast.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah.
But all three of those movies have. I was thinking about that when I was watching. I'm like, wow, they did that really well. You know, each one of them.
Yeah. All the beloved characters. Like you were pointing out with When Harry Met Sally, Carrie Fisher, and for me, Bruno Kirby, like, you know, the supporting, they have to be just as important. The B subplot or those characters, every romance kind of has the best friend. And usually after like 2000, it was kind of the slutty best friend is the best friend who says like all the stuff. And, you know, it became a cliche. But what I love is she has all of these different characters from different generations.
Yeah. And
they're all interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, and that's, I feel like the one designated, you know, friend, whatever, is kind of, you know, you need more.
You do. Like the older woman at the bookstore. He ran Spain.
Exactly.
Right. I think that that made me think, and again, while I'm thinking about this, that Nora was particularly gifted at writing even characters who might be less likable or less desirable in another setting. She made everybody appealing and likable, even the ones who were the antagonists, even, you know, everybody, even Dabney Coleman, who just had made bad choices in his life and everything, you still loved him. And I think that was what she brought to all of her movies. Yeah.
Well, and I think she does it with humor. And, you know, everybody's intelligent and witty and, you know, so you can't help but like them. It's like, there's nobody that's just like a doofus. You know what I mean? It's
like, right.
Or if they are, they're, you know, a lovable doofus that has a pithy moment, you know,
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the Bruno Kirby, and there's the joke. If any of us had found either one of them remotely attractive, like that wedding wouldn't happen between him and Carrie Fisher. But the throwaway line that I love so much at the where they all meet up and they're trying to make the other date happen is when she says she doesn't like Jimmy Breslin, and he just kind of like looks down and he goes, well, he's the reason I became a writer, but that's not important. And it's like all of us have been in that situation where someone's like, I hate westerns, or I hate musicals. Okay. I'm gonna power through, but
need my SOS, get me out of here.
Yes, exactly. But Parker Posey is kind of that in this film. It would have been so easy to make her stereotypical like bitch character, like kind of the John Hughes movies had that sometimes, but like Some Kind of Wonderful. I'm glad they didn't do that with the Lea Thompson character, but here in this movie of Parker Posey, and you should hate her, but then at the end, she wants to hire the Meg Ryan character, which I love because she recognized her and thought she should write children's books.
Yeah.
And has there ever been a better breakup than Greg Kinnear and Meg Ryan in that restaurant? I mean, it was beautifully done. Yes. And you were cheering. And they were cheering for it. It was like, that was so well. Yes.
Yeah. Because they were relieved. I don't love you. Yeah.
I don't love you either. Oof.
Oh, good. We can be friends. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know they're going to be friends. My goodness. Yes. It's such a good one. I think the cast, the music in this movie, like you were talking about with Death Set, they don't make movies essentially like this anymore. They don't really make movies like You've Got Mail anymore. First of all, they're not making romantic comedies about adults, I should say. They aren't making movies for grown-ups, really. Like, I don't know. In the movies today, they like crash into each other, and then all of a sudden they hate each other, and they're being like really aggressively angry at a stranger for no reason because they both reached for the peanuts in the at the airport, and you're like, nobody does that. Like,
who walks around that angry?
Like, yes, and now we're supposed to root for them to be together, you know. This is a movie with complex, three-dimensional people. I know some of my critic friends didn't like that, you know, he puts her out of business. The whole movie is about consumerism and greed, and you know, but it's just a beautiful film. Yes. But can we just enjoy it? It is about greed.
Timely, though, too, because, I mean, it came out before the rise of Amazon.
Yes. You
I think it was really more a punch at Borders and Barnes and Noble, you know.
Yeah.
But we had B. Dalton and Walden Books growing up, so I mean,
Oh my God, I loved going to Walden Books. Like, they had one shelf for a film collection. I think I bought the whole thing, yeah, over the
It's like,
years.
I'll take those.
Yes. They're like, we don't have to restock. We only have one buyer. But yeah.
But I think it's also too, it's like, I mean, it's easy to be dismissive, but it's also the kind of thing, she's maintaining this bookstore because she loved her mom. So it's really kind of a
Yes.
story about grief, and that maybe her purpose was a higher purpose, to be a
Yeah.
children's book author. She had things to say, you know, and without that push of losing the business. And I know they wrote it probably to make it okay that he put her out of business, but it's not like
Yeah.
she was living in a box under a bridge. It was like she was stepping into a
No.
higher calling, which she, you know, how many people do we know who never pursue their dreams because they're afraid? You know, it's like I've met a million
Yes.
people like, oh, I'm going to write a book someday. It's like, well, would that be today? It's like, I don't know where that is on
Yeah.
your calendar, but you know, and sometimes you need that hard shove, you know?
Yeah, or I'm gonna go to Paris at some point in my life, or I'm gonna do that. Yeah,
About
exactly.
now.
Yes. Write a book set there, you can write it off. I mean, there you go.
Paying. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I love this. Do you guys have any thoughts that we stuff we didn't touch on for You've Got Mail or any of these? I'm putting
I
you on
think
the spot.
I
No, it's
well,
okay.
I think the fact that it, I mean, when you were putting out suggestions for movies, and then of course Desk Set and You've Got Mail came into play, they felt very much tied together. I think what surprised me the most was how much Charing Cross Road was also tied in.
Yeah.
The two of them, it felt like a wonderful progression of seeing those types of movies over the different years and bringing that in. I just thought it was a great progression. I think they're a fabulous trio of movies. They were just really terrific. Yeah.
Yes, I know people listening, please forgive me. Like, Desk Set technically isn't a bookshop movie, but it's an extension. We kind of have to include that. Yeah, just go with it.
It
Yes.
still worked. It still fit
Yes.
together. I think it's kind of what Jen was saying. The ensemble cast maybe is
Yeah.
what brought everything together so well, but I think it worked really well.
Well, I
I
think
think there are
bet.
similarities too. It's like you have three very smart females, you know, and they're all achieving, you know, which I
Yeah.
love that. I love that kind of representation. And for the heroes, when I was kind of stepping back and looking at all three of the heroes, and you had touched on it before, Jen, it's like the way, you know, Spencer Tracy was looking at Kathleen Hepburn,
Yeah.
you know, Sumner was looking at Bunny, you know, if we want to go in character. And I think there's moments where, you know, because Tom Hanks knows who she is, but she doesn't know who he is in You've Got Mail. And there's moments when
Yeah.
he's looking at her like that. And then in Charing Cross, of course, it's epistolary, so it's through the letters. But he's when he's he like, you know, because they narrated it so well. You're hearing
Yes.
her voice when, you know, they're reading the letters. But even Anthony Hopkins has that look on his face, you know, the excitement of getting
Yes.
a letter from her and being excited about what she's going to say. And I love, like, in the very beginning when, you know, the language, what is it, a common language divided by an ocean, that quote or something about American. And she's saying, well,
Yes.
does madam mean the same thing in the UK as it means here? You know, because he calls her madam and is very proper. And I just was, I don't know. I just really liked that you had strong, intelligent male heroes that were kind of dazzled by the females, not threatened, not trying to
Yes.
alpha them, you know. And I mean, I write heroes like that. They call them beta or cinnamon rolls, you know. They're
Yeah.
guys that, you know, don't mind being in a woman's shadow. Like, they don't feel you know, diminished, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I saw that in all three of those movies, and I just thought, yeah, that's cool. I would like that to be the norm.
Yes. Yeah. And asking yourself what you look for in a man, too, because you have two of these characters who are involved with people they probably shouldn't be involved with, which is interesting. Yeah. And then here comes this other person who brings something new to the table. Yeah. Exactly. Well, other movies that you guys want to recommend, favorite book movies, anything of the theme, anything that's inspired your work, any shout outs to people wanting to watch more movies like this or anything?
I'm trying to think. Well, we already covered When Harry Met Sally, which
I
is not a book
know.
movie, but it's a great movie.
This is always hard. It's like, as a critic, people would walk up like, what should I see? And everything flew out of my mind every time. It's like, what's a movie? Like, you just kind of, I did, like, I just wrote 5,000 words on an essay for a booklet, but I don't know. Like,
I feel like that when people say, what should I read? And I'm a
yeah.
librarian, so I should be better than that. But for a movie, well, I will say this, for book-based things, I'm watching, I'm streaming A Discovery of Witches right now. And I had
Oh,
read the
okay.
book and I love the book. But I mean, if you love something that's, a love of books and then a strong hero, a very smart heroine, that's right on. It's a fantasy version of it all, but it's on point. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Did
What
they
about you, Paige? Can you think
one
of
or
any?
two seasons of that? I can't remember.
I think there's three.
Okay. I do have a friend who friend's girlfriend wrote for that show. So I don't know
It's
which.
good. They did a really
Yeah.
good
Okay.
job. I mean, I read the first book and really liked it. And then the second book, it goes back to an Elizabethan time, which was also interesting because,
Yeah.
but anyway, yeah. But if you like books and the love of books and
Cool.
witches, whatnot, it's good.
I'm drawing a blank on anything book, but when Jen mentioned streaming, I did recently watch the Lessons in Chemistry adaptation on Apple TV from the book. And when you think strong women, that's what comes to my mind is something that I've read and experienced recently that is super extraordinary and strong female part with a man, like Jen was saying, who basks in the glow of their partner and the intelligence so I found that was pretty special. There really aren't books as much as chemicals, but that was pretty
Yeah.
terrific.
I love the love story in that one too, though. Like you were,
Yes.
he's pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was such a good, yes. I loved
Yes.
the Tupperware and the making of the food for lunch. It was great.
That was a great, yeah. And
Yes.
again, that's one where the ensemble cast is fantastic.
Yep.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Just kind of like cozies and these movies that we talked about today. Well, ladies, I want to thank you so much. I probably talked your ear off and kept you too long, but it was such a pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was delightful.
You'll have to come
Thank
back for
you.
another topic when Harry Met Sally or anything else.
Let's do
Sounds
it.
good. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.